academics are all itching to kind of be participants in the decision-making process, the committees of pension funds and endowments, foundations, and us practitioners are all itching to get up and talk to academics about all the stuff that we do. And of course, none of us really quite ever succeed at the mission. So again, thank you for your patience. I know the way it's been working so far. I guess questions are at the end, but again, if you've got questions that you want to ask as I go through this, by all means, feel free to ask them. I'm going to be looking, as I mentioned, lessons from capital market history. There is an updated handout, which you should all have in front of you. Some of you may need a magnifying glass to look at those charts. Again, if there are particular charts that you want to get from me, just give me your card or your email address, and I'll send them off to you. The essence of the message that I want to leave you with today is that we have certain beliefs, and I believe those are spurious beliefs, about capital markets, how they work, how they operate. And what I'm going to do is actually look at some of those beliefs and dissect them and just really uncover what can we truly learn from capital market history to make us more successful investors. Now, most of what I'm going to be talking about is from an institutional perspective. So those of you that are retail investors will find little application in what I'm talking about. I mean, there may be some gleans, some lessons that you can pull away from. But some of the messages that I have, some of the hard-hitting messages, really deal with institutional investors and how they have been successfully managing their funds over the time. I'm known for my top 10 lists, and if you'll bear with me, I've got top 10 lessons from capital market history. Number 10 is markets fluctuate. Now, some of these aren't funny, but if you can humor me, because I spent a very long time putting this list together. It was very difficult for me, actually, to come up with this list. Number 9, to be a successful forecaster, make predictions of the past. We've seen that happen over and over again, where people data mine history and come up with wonderful predictions of the past. Number 8, if you need to pick only one stock in Canada, call Professor Molesky and ask him what that stock is. Obviously, he exited at the right point. He doesn't want to be called or harassed. Number 7, regression to the mean for currencies is a fallacy. The yen has been regressing or trying to regress for over 50 years, as many investors have found when investing in Japan. Number 6, you have better odds at winning at American Idol than you do at market timing. Number 5, any Leaf fans here? Anyhow, if you actually look at the statistics over the past 75 years, and you can see what I use my analysts for, very important data crunching. There's the data. The Leafs win the cup every 6.8 years with a standard deviation of 37. Now, here's the crunch. To properly diversify, don't listen to what your profs are telling you. Buy the market with a lotto 649. You've got a much better opportunity of winning if you do that. Number 3, for every expert, there is an equal and opposite expert. So everything that I will say today will be contradicted, I'm sure, by another expert in the audience who I obviously will hold in due respect. Number 2, if you really are so smart, why aren't you actually managing money? Well, I can finally say that we are managing money. I spent my whole career as a consultant telling people on the one hand and on the other hand, and finally I got a real job working at a firm that manages money. And the number 1 lesson from capital market history is, and it sounds trivial, but if all you learn from this is buy low and sell high, you've got it made. Okay. So again, all of the handouts are there, but the top 10 list, because I find that people keep taking them and using them without attributing them to me, which gets me upset. So here are the spurious beliefs on capital markets and investment strategies, and I use the word spurious because, you know, whether it's CNBC or whether it's us as individual investors or whether it's your professors or institutional investors, there are some underlying beliefs that we have about markets from which we build models from. And I think they're spurious because when you actually analyze capital market history, I think you reach some very different conclusions. Now, you can all read this. I'm just going to quickly speed read it for you. You know, business cycles are predictable. I mean, how many times do you open up the TV and there is some economist telling you when the recession is going to begin or when the how much longer the expansion is going to continue for? There is this underlying belief that we can predict the business cycle. We'll take a look at the data in a minute. Another underlying institutional perspective is that stock market cycles last for about 4 years. In other words, if you're trying to invest, to analyze any strategy or investment manager, you should do it over 4 years because that's giving them a fair chance. You're looking over a full market cycle. Number three, market timing is a high-odds strategy. You constantly read about all of the winners that got it right in terms of moving out of stocks over the past 3 years or going short duration. Again, well, look, whether or not it truly is a high-odds strategy, I got to love these two. Again, I have my MBA. Actually, one of my professors is here, and he will testify that I got one of the lowest grades in his class. I won't mention who he is. I'll let you guys sort of guess. It's a little bit of this perversion, right, where the most successful people in terms of book smarts tend out to go on to academic. The least successful go on to be successful business people. I won't hold myself out to be on that, but there's that inverse correlation sometimes. And this was one of the key lessons that got drilled into you that, first of all, you can't beat the market, and number two, that markets are efficient. Usually in the reverse, right? The markets are efficient, and you might say, okay, markets aren't efficient. Well, then if markets aren't efficient, then you have to go out and try to beat the market, and then perhaps number two falls apart because you really can't beat the market when you try to do it. Roger talked a little bit about this, stocks outperforming bonds, and I think we are brought up as practitioners, as investors, to believe this, and again, we'll look at the data. Of course, risk is standard deviation of returns. We heard, at least over the past 4 to 5 years, that international investing is dead, so why should you bother internationally investing? And the last point is that the small cap effect has disappeared. So here are the spurious beliefs that people have about, I believe, about capital markets and investment strategies. Let's dissect each of these one by one. For those of you in the back, this is a lesson in why you shouldn't sit in the back anytime I present. I usually put charts up like this that either test your eyes or null you to sleep. The reason the chart is up here is really, first of all, just to let you know the data, as I'm sure most of you are aware of, but those of you that aren't aware of it, easily available. Just go on the NBER website. We're looking here at expansions and contractions or recessions going all the way back to 1854 in the U.S. And the key message I want to draw out for you from this, you know, when you're talking about the predictability of business cycles, is just get a look at the statistics over the entire period of time. So this is the summary statistics from the previous chart. The average recession over the 150 years of data that we have lasted about 1.5 years. Expansions lasted about 3.1 years for a total average cycle of 4.6. But then if you look at the standard deviation of that data, you're looking at 1 year for recessions and you're looking for expansions at 2.2 years in total cycle standard deviation of 2.2, which is highly significant if you put it into perspective of the length of the total cycle running at about 4.6. And so there is a fair degree of volatility. Now, Zarnowitz has done a whole bunch of excellent work on business cycles, as I'm sure you're all aware of. And you know, one of his key conclusions is that post-World War II cycles, which is why we have this dichotomy, have become less shallow in the sense of going into recession periods, which you can see they have, and the expansions have gotten longer, which you can see they have. And the total net benefit is that we have a longer cycle with perhaps not as deep as recession as we've had in the past using post-World War II data. Nonetheless, you still have what I would call significant deviation, whether you're looking at recessions in terms of the average length of recessions or whether you're looking at the average length of the cycle with a standard deviation of 3, and for a total cycle variation of 2.9. And I think, you know, you got to be amazed, those of you that can look at the previous chart, look at the data, and reach any form of conclusion that there is some predictability to the length of business cycles. And because we're a Canadian group and we want to feel good that we're Canadians, I've done the same thing for Canadian business cycles, and this is a legible chart. But you pretty much reach the same conclusion. Right? And that conclusion is when you look at the average years for whether it's for the recession part or for the expansion part or for the total cycle part, the variability in the average cycle, if there is such a thing as an average cycle, and I think Roger made a good joke before, 51% of the babies on average are male and 49% are women. But what does that mean? And I think similarly speaking, when you look at business cycles and you try to assess how predictable are they from a practitioner's perspective, I would conclude that they are highly variable as opposed to predictable. And why we spend any time listening to economists, no offense to any of them in the room, trying to predict or forecast business cycles is beyond my comprehension. When you look at stock market cycles, and there is this underlying belief in the institutional business, again, that's the business that I am in, that when you assess your money managers or when you're assessing investment strategies, you should look over a cycle. And so a cycle implies regularity, not to be compared to other things. And when you think of that, you say to yourself, okay, what is the cycle? What is the average length? So somehow in the marketplace, there's crept in this underlying belief that a cycle is 4 years. And whether or not it's tied to the requirement for actuarial valuations every 3 years, plus you add another year onto it, I don't know. But when you actually look at the average duration of bull and bear markets, it's closer in totality to having an average cycle of 6 years. There is one typo. I would X out these numbers over here. These numbers are not correct. And for those of you that are wondering what the true numbers are, after I hire a new analyst, I'll let you know. If you move ahead then to what I consider to be the basic thoughts or conclusions on looking at business cycles and stock market cycles both in Canada and the U.S., and again, the same data is applicable to the U.S. marketplace. You have the same issue when you look at U.S. stock market data. I believe business and market cycles are highly variable. It therefore is extremely challenging, and I believe almost impossible to call the turns in the cycle. As well, I think we can conclude as business people, at least at this point, and Czarnowitz has written again, as I mentioned, quite a bit on this, that post-World War II business cycles are longer in duration with shorter recessions. And managers, I believe, should be assessed over a 5 to 6 year basis, over a longer period than 4 years. Now, some of you may say I have a hidden interest in that, given that I work for a money manager and I want to have a longer period of time. But, you know, the by and large conclusions when you look at the data is that 4 years is probably too short of a period to incorporate both bull and bear markets from an assessment perspective. Have I said anything controversial so far? No, nobody would argue with me, right? So it's only going to get worse. Let's look at market timing. Now, yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. Well, not that I want to point you out as being the professor that I had the lowest grade in, Professor Wolf, but, and it wasn't really the lowest. I did really well in economics, but international, I don't know. Never got the TP thing or the regression to the mean or anyway. But, you know, the underlying thesis, and I hope I was fairly clear on it, is that we have these beliefs and then we try to build models to justify the beliefs. And so, you know, people believe that business cycles are, and I don't know how you're going to build any model when there's such a degree of variability in it. You know, it's the same thing with dealing with risks and returns, and really it's probably the underlying thesis in this that I throw back to the academics is that we need much better model building. And I have some suggestions. We can get to that at the end, but it's a great question. Market timing, a high odds strategy. How many of you believe that you can actually time the market? None of you. Okay, then I don't have to make the argument. No, let me just take 1 second because I need to explain the chart anyhow. What this is a study of it's actually 6 studies, so it's an aggregation of both U.S. and Canadian studies. They're more applied studies, but not really the heavy-duty ones, you know, the ones you see in the Journal of Finance and all that sort of stuff. It's more stuff from the Financial Analyst Journal, Journal of Portfolio Management, the loser stuff that practitioners read. What it's trying to do is put the results of those studies into various distributions and buckets. And so if you look at the results, at least on market timing or asset mix timing, in other words, trying to move the mix around to make money, what you see is that the median of that study lost 40 basis points. This is all gross results before fees. Even if you manage to be the first quartile child, right, the winning student in the distribution, you only added 10 basis points. So when you look at people that are paid gobs of money to try to implement these types of strategies, you kind of walk away with your tail between your legs to conclude, gee, market timing is pretty tough business. What's really interesting is the security selection side, which we're going to come back to, where you see the median result was about zero. And again, these are gross numbers before fees, which is pretty much, I think, what you would empirically expect in the very long term, that the median result from any study of active management would be about the market, which is what this is suggesting. But we're going to come back to that right now. There shouldn't be a question mark in here. What this is saying is the market is efficient, right? That's what we've been taught to believe. Various forms of what you would call market efficiency, whether it's the weak form, the semi-strong form, the strong form, whatever form you like, you can decide how you want to apply it. I guess where I want to take a step back and get a closer look at is this wonderful, this is from Jeremy Siegel, but the original work was done by Summers and Cutler and Potterbaugh, I think I'm pronouncing the name correctly, and they looked at the relationship between announcements in the New York Times, which we know is the newspaper to read, if you want to know what's happening in the market or trying to understand the market, versus the largest chains in the market over time. And you can see what Jeremy has done here in terms of summarizing the results. He's just picked, he hasn't selected all of them. That's what the rank means. The second biggest move, 14.87% up in the market. The date was October 6, 1931. And the rationale was that Hoover urges $500 million pool to help banks. Now, when you look down the rationale in terms of the reasons given for the market moves, you'll see that on average about 25% of those market moves seem to have a pretty good rationale for them, which unfortunately leaves three-quarters of the other market moves as not having good rationale for what actually occurred in the marketplace. And you know, you don't have to look too far down. October 27th, 1997, that's number 26 in terms of ranking. The market was down 7.18%, and the reason was the attack on the Hong Kong dollar. And again, if you look down the list in terms of trying to explain why the market changed so dramatically in one day, I think you'd find most of the rationale falls short, and that's the Summers Cutler article that basically says, gee, there doesn't appear, we don't seem to have good ways of explaining why the market all of a sudden makes dramatic moves, whether they're up and down. Now, and I would raise that kind of questions this whole issue of market efficiency in the sense that the market very accurately or appropriately reflects fully the information that's publicly known. Forget about, you know, insider trading or the strong form. And I think you can really explain some of this by what we call crowd behavior. Now, most of you are going to look at these titles and not admit to having bought any of these books. I will admit to having bought them all because sometimes I need a good laugh. And it wasn't too long ago when the most popular books were saying the Dow is going to be at 36,000. Somebody came out and bet and went even further. The Dow is going to be at 100,000. And of course, I think some of you probably recall that back in 2000, you could have a taxi ride with your taxi driver really telling you what stocks you should be buying. And they weren't really driving cabs. They had their computer up front, and they were actually doing day trading because taxi driving was just a hobby. They are really professional traders. And I think it is The popularity of markets, the ease with which individuals with noise, with no information, can play, that really helps to contribute to market inefficiency in a broad sense, which I think is nicely summarized by this cartoon from the New Yorker, where the crowd mania or the push, all you need is the momentum to begin. And again, I think there is some evidence from what I've seen, at least in some of the latest research, to suggest that momentum is a strategy that today is not arbitraged out of the market, but is actually run by other hedge funds who are trying to ride that momentum curve. And so rather than in the old days, right, when Milton Friedman argued that arbitragers would help to bring markets back to efficiency, what you're finding today is that the true speculator or hedge fund or whatever you want to call them is actually riding the feedback traders and riding the curve. Of course, the question is to get out in time. And some of them, as we've seen, have closed shop and did not get out in time at all. So I think as long as we have people playing with what they think is information or believing that they are super people in terms of trading in the marketplace, we're going to have markets, broadly speaking, that are not efficient. Which then takes me to, okay, you might say to me, fine, we don't think markets are efficient either, but nonetheless, you can't beat the market. And it comes back to a wonderful article by Professor Sharp back in 1991 in the FAJ. And his equation was fundamentally obvious, which is that before costs, the return on the average actively managed dollar will equal the return on the average passively managed dollar. So if you think for a minute, and of course the second one is once you take costs into effect, you're going to be below that. If you think about that for a minute, you can actually still believe that markets are inefficient, but then the question comes down to how are you going to take advantage of it? How are you going to beat the market? Now, modern portfolio theory tells you, and I believe in modern portfolio theory, that you should have a professionally managed portfolio, widely diversified, reducing unsystematic risks, et cetera, hold the world market portfolio. Now, if you believe then in inefficiency, you're going to look for managers that can beat the market. So then the question becomes, if you can only find a median manager, if your success, if your skill at selecting managers constantly or consistently results in median managers, you're still going to lose the game. So most of you are saying, okay, it sounds like a tough game. This is a really tough chart. I think you can read it from the handout. If you can't, let me know. I can't read it from up here either. So maybe, no. What it basically looks at is the distribution of quarterly rolling five-year value added in different asset classes. Again, I always work gross of fees. I'm in the institutional business, so if you want to, take fees into account, you're a big fund, you take off 20, 30, 40 basis points depending on your asset class. And if you look at the various asset classes, there's a couple of things that stand out, and that the header kind of gives it away. Professionals have actually been beating the market, but it depends which market you look at. So when you look at the results of the distribution for the period, and this is over 10 years, period 91 through to 01, if you look at the median result, for example, for global equity managers, it's about 111 basis points. The mean is about 100. First quartile is 315 basis points in terms of value added. And top third is about 200 basis points. And you can look similarly across the various asset classes to come up with the average alphas. Usually I put a caveat up. It takes me too long to go through the caveat. But there's all sorts of problems with this analysis. I'm the first one to admit it. There's survivorship bias. I'm looking over overlapping periods. It's not independent. But the bottom line is, as Paul Samuelson said, we have only one period of history to examine. I mean, that's all I have to work with. And I'm trying to build up a large enough sample size. And, when you look at perhaps the one asset class that I don't think anybody's too surprised about with the results is in U.S. equities, where the median was about 169 basis points of value lost, the mean was 181 basis points. I think as a practitioner, you can explain what happened in the 90s in the U.S. equity marketplace, and it really comes down to a couple of factors. It was a very strong bull market, as we know, and because active managers generally hold cash, cash is a drag on performance. As well, it tended to be a very much a large cap marketplace, and managers tend to have their portfolios equally weighted towards mid cap and to some degree small cap. And I'm using the Russell 1000 as a benchmark, so it's not quite an apples to oranges comparison. What I'm basically saying, my message in these charts, is that managers have been able to beat the market. Of course, there's going to be times when they don't. And I think this summary chart sort of says it all. And what it does is it looks back to 1960 in the Canadian equity marketplace, and it looks at the median manager result quarter after quarter. It looks at the excess value added. And again, you can't buy the median manager, as you all know. But nonetheless, it's just an indicator of the market, you hope, in the long term. And then it's got the four-year annualized results over a period of time, and it's got the cumulative results. Now, let me point out a couple of things, which I think will become very obvious to you. Can you imagine if you were invested in active management all through this period of time, through to the bottom of 1979? Can you imagine the enormous amount of pain you would have suffered? If there was anybody left in the planet, or at least in Canada, that actually had active management, right, you'd say you're stupid, right? What do you, why would you have active management? Sure, there was one pop-up here in terms of the median manager versus the TSE, but at the end of the day, the cumulative results were absolutely awful in terms of value lost relative to just simply buying the index. But look what happened. Nonetheless, in the long term, you had this general movement upward where active management was winning. You had a period of time where it was a seesaw. Of course, we had the Nortel bubble where most active managers simply couldn't invest the required amount to have them match the index. And then recently, of course, with the bear market where active management tends to do better relative to the index, and of course with the bursting of the Nortel bubble, you can see the comeback in active management. So, I mean, my conclusions in this area is, in terms of beating the market, you can find professionals that are going to beat the market. It does happen. The real challenge you face is twofold. Recognize that you may have to spend a long period of time where active management is not winning. Does that mean you should change your belief? I don't know. I mean, just, you know, that's an issue you have to face. The market rewards different factors over different periods of time, and it's very difficult to forecast what those factors are going to be. At least I believe it is. Yeah. No. Well, the four year is annualized, and the red. After 40 years, the cumulative number. Yeah. Well, actually, no, the annualized number since inception, sorry, is zero. And thank you for pointing that out. And so actually, at the end of the whole period of time, it finally turns out that Professor Sharp was right, that cumulative speaking, before cost, the average manager, the median, is going to be the market. Thank you for pointing that out. I didn't mention that. That's the red bullet at the end. Depending when you measured it, the average manager may have looked like a real hero, or he could have looked like a real loser. So my two conclusions on this is, first of all, there are times when active management has done very well, but recognize there are times when active management hasn't done well. And the fact that markets reward different factors has a lot to do with it. And I don't get into that in this presentation, but that's my conclusion on that point. Stocks outperform bonds. Now, statistics don't lie. But know your statistician, right? That's the old saying. And I'm a great cook, not in the kitchen, but you know, I really spend a lot of time trying to understand capital markets, what drives them, how they work. And in this case, what I'm looking at, it's data that you can get from the Canadian Institute of Actuaries. It says Scotia Capital as well, because at some point in the data, I switched over to the Scotia Capital Bond Universe Index as a way of determining the annual equity premium. And so really what we're looking at is the differential at least up until the Scotia Index came into being, which is somewhere in the mid-70s, I mean, somebody I'm sure here will tell me for sure, versus the TSX or the TSE 300. And what you can see I've done is I've divided up the entire period into various what I would call economic regimes. Now, first of all, over the entire history in Canada, you can see that the average premium, the differential between stocks and bonds, has been about 5%. Pretty healthy, but you've got to go, you know, this is data from 26 through to 02. Now, you know, the way we think of markets is it's great to analyze the whole summation, as Roger was saying, but what we're really concerned about is the future. And one way of building forecasts of future equity premiums is to say, what type of economic regime are we going into? And so what I've done here is dichotomize various historical economic regimes just to help individuals come up with future economic regimes. Now, if you look at these regimes, what you would conclude with, and below each of the regime is the equity premium over that period of time. Now, what conclusions would you have if you were in the laboratory looking at this data and trying to come up with future economic scenarios? I think you would pretty much conclude, you know what? Having a positive equity premium that's significant is probably a good odds bet. No, in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 5 out of 6 scenarios, when I roll the dice, I end up with a very significant positive equity risk premium. But again, as I said, statistics don't lie, just know your statistician. And so what I do in the next period is really sub-dichotomize the economic regimes to ones I think that are more likely for us to live through. In other words, most of us don't live in 15-year economic regimes. I mean, the patience for the average policy is about 2 to 3 years. And we just saw it over the past 3 years coming out of the bear market. Why anybody was surprised that they lost money in a 3-year bear market is beyond, you know, my understanding. That's the way markets work. And in this case, you can see that the odds significantly start to stack up against having a positive equity premium relative to bonds. In this case, you can see we've got 4 out of 9 scenarios, which tells you, gee, the odds are significantly better than most of us think, unless we live in Jeremy Siegel's, you know, 100-year history of having periods where stocks do underperform bonds. The average premium hasn't changed, right? So, you know, I think when you're trying to look at this data, there's a number of different ways of cutting it. I put this in because Roger's speaking, but actually, it's a wonderful piece. It's an article that he had written with Peng Chen, and it's in the FAJ. Those of you here that are saying, how can we actually understand the past? One way is through economic scenarios in terms of trying to build forecasts of the future. The other way is through this building block approach. I would strongly suggest you read this article because I can't summarize the wealth of importance and knowledge in terms of you looking to build scenarios of the future. What Roger with his colleague does as well is then say, that's the past. Here's how you can use these building blocks to build future scenarios. And I think if you, those of you that are really interested in this and are trying to work with asset mix and asset allocation, this is the article I think you should be reading, and Roger's not paying me anything for this. I just want to spend 30 seconds on the great debate of the future with Siegel in one corner, Arnott in the other corner. Those of you that are up to date with stuff, Siegel basically argues things aren't going to be as bad as Arnott thinks they're going to be. It really comes down to what is their forecast for dividend growth in the future. And so this is a highly simplistic model. I've given you the chart on the bottom in terms of S&P 500 nominal earnings growth rate. Actually, the source for that is Ibbotson. It got cut off. But you can see the mean and the median and why it's so important when you're coming up with forecasts of the future to have some estimate as to what you think the end result will be in terms of dividend growth. Because clearly at the current 1.5% yield, we're not going to be able to have the types of equity risk premiums that we've had in the past. We've all been taught that risk is standard deviation of returns. How many of you believe it? Not many. Okay, well, I'm out of date then. Well, one person. Density of returns for Alcatel is just an example from the great financial econometrics book. Clearly, when you look at the distribution of returns for individual securities, what you find, you know, just to generalize, is they tend to have heavy tails, and they also tend to be peaked. Again, these are generalizations. To me, the hottest research in this area in trying to understand stocks and asset classes is this heavy distribution analysis and trying to understand what the history has looked like and what we can expect in the future. I put in the asset class example as well, just to show you that under a normal return distribution, you're not going to pick up five standard deviation events like October 87, which is the problem with using standard deviation as your definition of risk. Let me just close off, because I know I'm running out of time here. You know, many sponsors lost patience with international investing, as the summary chart describes. Unfortunately, I think it's a little bit like, is the king dead? I mean, if you Google Elvis Presley, he comes up close to a million times, which tells you I think he's kind of alive. The question I'd like to leave you with, in terms of his music, that is, and I think the music for international investing still holds very true. If you're a Canadian investor, just look at the various sector differences between Canada and the U.S., and I've highlighted the yellow important ones. And then as well, look at the differentials between the world and Canada. Why would you want to put 5% of your money in the Royal Bank versus the distribution you can get by reallocating among GE, Exxon, and Pfizer? So I think international investing is still very much alive. And my last point to close off is this question of the small cap effect has disappeared. This was a great study done by Dimson, Marsh, and Stoughton. The end result is they looked over the period from 1988 through to 1999 or 1998, and they discovered the differential has definitely worked against small cap. Now, you should know then that by the time the academic world has discovered this, the reverse has happened, which is what occurred in the last chart. You can see that small caps as an investment strategy bottomed kind of in mid-99 and then dramatically turned around. And what you're looking at here is the differential between small cap and large cap and the rolling one-year excess return. So I don't think the small cap effect has disappeared. I just think, again, the markets didn't reward that particular factor over the decade that was looked at by Dimson. And, of course, now the factor has come back over the past couple of years since 1999. In conclusion, I am very confident that people will continue to act like humans, which, you know, when you look at many of these underlying beliefs that I've tried to dissect, I don't think they're going to disappear, which hopefully your challenge as investors is to figure out how can you capitalize, at least in the sense of what capital market has taught us as investors in the sense of putting together good portfolios and smart investment strategies. And